The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.
Hi, I'm Candace Michelle, and this is another segment for Our Community, a show about some of the people and events making the local news. In my last show, I had the pleasure of chatting with the new forest supervisor for Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest, Merv George, and Kate Road resident and Tolowa Dene Nation Tribal Council Vice Chair, Cherry Lynn Thompson, about a new direction in forest management and how neglecting our forests is leading to the megafires we're now seeing. Ms. Thompson and the other residents on Kate Road watched the Chetco Bar fire last year roar up through their lands, destroy their homes, and burn their timber. This year's fire season started earlier and is predicted to last longer, and once again we're waking up to the acrid smell of smoke and an orange sun. My show this week continues the discussion. I'm joined again by Cherry Lynn Thompson telling her Chetco Bar fire story, and additional guests, Al Stroh and Guy McMahon, two residents of Brookings that decided to look into the facts surrounding that disastrous fire to try to determine what went wrong and how the fire was allowed to march within 5 miles of Brookings, resulting in thousands of evacuations. Today is the anniversary, really, the one-year anniversary of the Chetco Bar fire blowing up and invading our space. And I had Cherry Lynn Thompson here with Merv George, who is our new forest supervisor, and we had a nice discussion about what the Forest Service's position is going to be and how the new management practices are going to be happening. What I wanted to do was take a look back at the Chetco Bar fire, because the people in this room were greatly affected by that, Cherry Lynn Thompson and the people up on Kate Road. And I also have with me Guy McMahon and Al Stroh, both of whom who have been working on a citizens group for about the last year, I think, to kind of take a look at what some of the things were that happened during the Chetco Bar fire, how it was handled or not handled, and, you know, what we can learn from that. So I'd like to start with you, Cherry Lynn, because we didn't really get kind of your story. And your story up on Kate Road is really a pretty moving one. Can you tell me about the fire as it was for you last year?
Thank you, Candace. The fire supposedly started on July 12th of 2017. I flew over the fire on July 19th, flying home from Portland to Crescent City. Then it went to, I believe, August 16th was the next picture we got of it blowing up. We could take that right from our house. I remember
calling. So you could literally see the fire from your house.
We could literally see the big blow up from the house. I sent the picture to my brother and asked him how far it was from the Tolman Ranch, which as kids we've been up to the Tolman Ranch. And he texted me back and said, it's not far. Consider the fire supposedly started on July 12th. This is August 16th. There's over a month there. Then it went to August 16th. We got that picture. Don't remember anything happening on the 17th. On the 18th was a Friday, and I was at a conference at the tribe, and my daughter texted me and said, Mom, get home. It's going to level 3 on Facebook. So I go home, and there's these contractors going back and forth down past the house at this time. The deputy sheriff comes up and says it's a level 2 evacuation. We say it's a level 3, but you know, we can still see the fire over here. We're, you know, there's a river between us, the Forest Service Road called 1376. So, okay, we got the information. Thank you. On Saturday morning, one of the contractors' crews come out and they were assessing the houses and the residences for defensibility. My daughter's house needed a little bit of weed eating in the back. It was tied with a green ribbon, which meant it was defensible. Firefighters could defend it. The neighbor, Tiny and Doreen Caudill, also received a green ribbon on their property, which meant it was defensible. So, okay, we did pack stuff up. We had two little motorhomes, and we got a lot of valuables in them. But you have to understand, we'd been there for, what, six generations, and so you got six generations at least of memorabilia that's there that you just can't pick up.
No.
They don't make trucks that big, no. frankly,
right.
to take away. So we did get a lot of our pictures, yeah, and a lot of stuff, but not nearly as I look back on it now what I could have got. Because we were complacent, we'll take some responsibility there because we went through the biscuit fire. So we thought that, you know, the fire's on the other side of the river. There's a big road over there. These people know how to fight fire. We went through the biscuit fire 15 years prior to this. We thought we would be okay. You got a ways to go to get to us. Then on Saturday, they were going up and down the roads. I decided to run down to the river to check on our friends Byron and Joyce Brim, make sure everything's okay. What's he hearing that we didn't hear or see that we didn't see? Byron had he'd worked for South Coast, and he'd actually drove CAT on the biscuit fire, so, and helped fight that fire. So he's, you know, well experienced in our neighborhood and in the backcountry. And that's where he said, Geraldine, it's not going to cross the river. They won't let it cross the river. And it's like, okay, Byron, okay. And we come back home, and we decided that all this time the wind is just howling. This Checo effect is just literally howling. And we come back home, and, you know, I got the grandkids, and I thought, well, we have the two motorhomes. Let's spend the night out at the top of the hill. And, you know, just in case, we got our stuff out, we'll spend the night out there in the motorhomes. So we did. We didn't get any sleep because the wind was blowing so hard.
Right.
So Sunday morning, I got up, and I went to the top of the hill, which is Palmer Butte, if any of you are familiar with Gardner Ridge, you know, the area. And I could see down toward Mount Emily because we were told that it was a problem down by Redwood, Little Redwood on the river. And you could see the smoke was just a boiling down there. But it's downriver from us. But there was also smoke boiling up from Palmer Butte. You look toward the north there. And so I thought, well, we'll take the cars back in. We'll leave the motorhomes here and go back in and see what's going on. And that was Sunday morning. We got out. We have an old fire truck. I think it holds, it's a city fire truck that I think it holds 200 gallons. So we decided to pump out the pond, get it full of water, and we sprayed Katrina's house down. And as, you know, equipment sits over the years, it doesn't work all the time. So my husband, something broke down, and he ran down to, took the grandson, ran down to the barnyard to where his shop was at to fix this part. And I don't know if you've ever heard a fire before, but it's like, Alan Van Diver explained it to me one time. It's like 14 locomotives right behind you. That's how loud it is. And Grandpa told the grandson, we got to hurry up and fix this. We don't have time to do this. So we run back up there. We got two sprays on the house of water, and all the time this is coming up, and we decide, they went back up to fill it up again. We motioned the guys, nope, it's, the trees are just whipping up there. We can see with the wind and the wind from the fire itself, and the noise is just unbelievable. So I said, okay, they're going to shut down. Let's go to the river. And Katrina started to the river, and it's just, just through some trees on the property, and the fire just blowed up in her face, basically. So she backed up. So then we had to turn around and come back and head out to town. And that's, you know, that's when it hit Lane and Cecilia Worlton's house. I mean, it was coming with such force. It was, and the total lack of communication, I believe, was just, yeah. And so we make it out to the motorhomes where we had them parked. We head down to the bottom of the hill and on Gardner Ridge, you know, where the old Upper Chetco Schoolhouse is, for those of you who are familiar with it, lined up was probably, I don't know, 50, 75 fire trucks. They're all sitting down there in that field.
Oh, my.
And so, you know, we had to bring vehicles out in stages. And so we had brought a couple down and left them at the Chetco Fire Station. And they wouldn't let me take the guys back up to get those vehicles out. They argued with us. And so the guys just took off walking to get the vehicles and so we could get them out. Total lack of communication.
It sounds absolutely horrible. And to have a fire that, you know, is so out of control that on the one hand, and, you know, not being told what was going on the other, it must have been a horrible experience.
It was a horrible experience. I like to learn from something from each experience mm-hmm. I go through. But it really triggered some PTSD for my son-in-law. Oh my gosh. My grandson, you know, his bags are packed. You know, he sees that big smoke plume mm-hmm. and it's, come on, Grandpa, come on. We got to make sure mm-hmm. we can go to town. I want to turn it into a positive situation, but you know, there's still a lot of grieving for the people to do. Some of my neighbors, I can call up and talk to them. They can't even talk to me yet. They have to hand the phone to their wife because it's so, so raw for them. So
wow, a year later.
A year later.
So, Guy, you and Al have been working with a local group. Can you tell me something about yourself? Who are you, Guy McMahon?
Well, I'm a retired businessman. Mm-hmm. Came to Brookings to retire in 2014, owned a house here since 97. Mm-hmm. I have experience with setting up two nonprofit corporations in the Bay Area, one for affordable housing and one for economic development. And thought I'd hung my hat up and came up here to enjoy the quiet life. I like to freshwater fish and just hang out. And this is a good place to do it. We really love Brookings.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Beautiful. And how about you, Al? Who the heck are you?
I'm a retired software developer. My better half, Susan Champeau, and I moved up here in 2007. We started coming up here, flying up here from San Diego in 1999 as invited guests and kite flyers for the Southern Oregon Kite Festival. And I wanted to move up here the day we got here, the first time we came up here, but Susie wasn't ready.
And well, she you're finally, here now.
yeah, she finally changed her mind in 2007, and,
well,
and we're here.
You can't find a prettier place than this.
No, you know, I grew up in a small town, and uh-huh. I love small towns, yeah. And I feel right at home here.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, if you talk to anybody in this community, they will have the same thing to say about the Chetco Bar Fire. It was a disaster. But not just a natural disaster, but it was a disaster in the way that it was handled. Certainly, if the majority of the citizens are getting their information from Facebook, you know that that's a problem, right? I mean, it's just a problem. So you guys have been doing what? What was this? What is this group that you're involved with?
Well, Curry Wildfire Prevention was the group that Al and I ultimately joined, but we were tearing our hairs out over this fire in July. and we're next door neighbors practically. And it became incomprehensible to both he and I that they were going to let this fire burn.
So you knew that the fire was happening in July, which was pretty soon after it got started.
Right.
And you were watching it.
Watching it and trying to catch up with the lack of communication that the Forest Service was putting out. But we were able to pinpoint right off the bat that Monty Edwards, who was a Type 2 team commander, was going to employ the MIST program on this fire, which minimal impact suppression tactics.
What does that mean?
It means light or light-handed fire protection. Let it burn.
Oh,
that's the issue. And both Al and I were tearing our hair out. That's just incomprehensible to let a fire burn 23 miles from town. That Chetco effect can make it travel 8 miles in a day. So in 2 days, if we're really going, it could catch up with us. And they let that fire burn for 32 days before lifting a hand on it. And Bob Hausman, who is the incident commander, NEMO incident commander, sent firefighters back. He had 200 firefighters. He let go 100. So they had no intentions of putting that fire out. They were going to try to skate through to the wet season, which comes around October 31st. Incomprehensible lunacy. That's sheer lunacy, as they came to find out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was not a natural disaster. It was a disaster by design. On day two or day three, July 13th, 14th, somewhere around there, Monty Edwards set up a 6 mile in every direction perimeter around the fire.
Miles away from the fire.
Was the perimeter, 6 miles
in all directions.
In every direction.
Okay.
That's, if it's a square, it's 144 square miles. And that was basically, for all intents and purposes, sacrificial forest. They were going to let it burn.
They were
that much of it.
They were going to let 92,000 acres burn before it caught up to their lines.
Was there a thought process? There must have been a thought process.
Well, it's a wilderness area, and that's one of the options in a wilderness area is mist.
Mm-hmm.
And that's let it burn. You know, it's the result of a lot of different things. You know, some of it's mandated through the Wilderness Act, and some of it is U.S. Forest Service policy.
And the policies, the Forest Service policies are written by the Forest Service and adopted by the Forest Service. They have no overseer, and all their overseers are Forest Service connected. So if this had been a cigarette fire started up there, they were mandated to put that fire out. Because it was a lightning fire, they had the option to employ mist or put the fire out. And they chose...
Okay, so it depends on the source of the fire,
correct.
not the environment,
well,
or not the potential
and
for...
And as rules and regulations, it's clearly written.
Obviously, though, it's an option. It's only an option. Merv George had the same option on the fires that are burning out there now,
right.
And he chose not to employ mist.
Yeah. Right.
The community was not in their attempt to manage this fire, the community was the last on their list. They were not concerned. They were hopeful of skating through and keeping that fire up in the old biscuit fire scar. And it did not work.
It's a little dangerous.
An insult to injury, for 32 days, there was no preparation for homeowners. They didn't go in to wrap them. They didn't go in to fireproof them. They didn't do anything. There was nothing planned on their in their documentation to handle homes. And in fact, they're precluded from putting a fire out on a home unless it's life-threatening. It's not their job to protect homes. It's in writing.
Jerry Lynn, you were going to say something?
I was going to say that the Chetco Bar Fire is the third major fire in the Calmeopsis Wilderness Area. So what the wilderness was created for has been completely ecologically changed. Now that's not there with all these fires. It's completely changed. And Merv was saying that he flew over it, and it did bring tears to your eyes to see the brush. He called them sticks, I believe. Mm-hmm. How immense they were out there. I mean, yeah, it's an issue. But back to Guy's point of the, and Al's point of the perimeter, they waited till it got out of the wilderness. That part of that 6 mile radius was to be out of the wilderness. But that's when the wind caught it.
Right. Right.
And I mean, we heard stories of repellers in there. Just give us some water. We could mm-hmm. put it out. Mm-hmm. And we're denied.
Yeah. It's kind of mind-boggling, really, you know? I mean, you think about how long that fire was burning. And you know, your point about people not being notified and not having the opportunity really to take some kind of action to handle their home or something. I mean, I didn't know that fire, I mean, maybe in the back of my head, I remember some news report about there being a fire out there, but it was out there. It had nothing to do with us. There was never any talk on any of the news reports about how it could come in. I mean, it wasn't discussed. I mean, the day that it blew up was the first day that I actually knew about it. That's shocking, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. That's symptomatic of how that whole fire was run. And it's inexcusable. Both Al and I are intent on making Jerry and the other 14 folks whole again.
You're talking about the Cate Road people?
Cate Road folks, yes.
Yeah.
It's an open wound and it's a scar. And notwithstanding anything that Merv brings to the table, that needs to be dealt with. And the Forest Service needs to recognize that that's they created a huge, huge trauma and a mess.
That is ongoing today.
Ongoing. Yeah.
I mean, you know, that.
And it will, you know, yeah. Some of it will never be resolved.
Right.
Yeah, they've destroyed lives through their incompetence.
Yeah. Yeah. And I might add, it's interesting to note that the last fire meeting where the Forest Service unveiled the Checobar fire timetable, the man principally responsible for the botched job, in my opinion, Bob Hausman, did not show, would not answer his phone or his emails.
Wow.
And they had a stand-in, Mr. Pendergast, to explain how the fire got out of control. And he had nothing to do with the fire.
Wow.
He was a stand-in trying to fill in for Bob
Hausman.
So he was
basically reading from notes.
Yeah, from notes. So,
wow.
And Bob Hausman is a training manager for Incident Command in NEMO. And
NEMO, again, is?
National
Incident
Management Organization.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they handle major incidents. It could be a hurricane. It could mm-hmm. be a flood. This time it happened to be a fire. Worst thing that ever happened to us was to bring that in.
So what do you think we've learned?
Well, I've learned that Merv George, he is a silver bullet to some extent. We've been hoping for a person like that to come in and run and supervise our forest. But he's constrained by the lack of resources, the lack of urgency, and the Federal Forest Service bureaucracy. It's very slow to recognize issues. It's very slow to approve them, and it's very slow to operate or try to make changes.
Mm-hmm.
And Al and I are trying to work on that privately. In addition to help the victims, you know, the immediate victims, try to recover their losses. And it's such a complicated issue, resolving the victims' losses. I'm devoting more time to that than I am to CWP. I think my time is gone at CWP, and I want to help Jerry and the 14 folks.
Tell me a little bit about that, Jerry Lynn. Who basically lost their homes and buildings? And
starting from the river, you got Byron and Joyce Brim that lost a lot of timberland. Mm-hmm. You got cousin Rip and Denise Gardner lost a lot of timberland. Andy and Shauna Larson, timberland. Mm-hmm. Mike Morris lost a vacation home. Then you got us. Then you got my daughter and her family. Next is Tiny and Doreen Caudell, lost their house. Next is Lane and Cecilia Worlton, lost their house. Sherry Long, her son Justin, lost their house. Rollo Park and Russ Suter was living on Russ Suter's property, lost his shop. Harold and Lisa Bailey didn't really lose a lot, I mean, other than the trauma there. Ted and Peggy Freeman stayed home. I think there was pictures floating around where they were, the fire was at their door, and Ted made the comment that the water's getting hot, you know, from spraying. So, and then there's Mike and Gail Morris, and they don't exactly live on Kate Road, but where the fire traveled the most during that day was the Panther Creek draw, which is right behind us. It got both sides of the draw. Mm-hmm. They live up Hazel Camp Road. They were the ones that nobody had notified anything about the fire. Some friend called them and told them, you better be moving out. So they had just put their home up there. They had two homes there. They had just listed it and lost both of them.
Wow.
So I think as a community, Merv brought up a really important point, is we need to be much more proactive.
Yes.
This winter, we need to get our stuff together, and we need to identify stuff that's important to us to protect.
I agree.
I'd like to make a real quick comment. This is not an issue of these folks having a home in the wrong place.
Right.
It's an issue of them not dealing with the fire.
Right.
And an 80-mile-an-hour, 60-mile-an-hour wind sending 2,000 degrees ahead of it burned them out. Yeah. They could have had 600 feet as clear space.
Right. It wouldn't have made
Bit of difference.
I think we're just about out of time, which is always amazing to me how fast everything goes when we're talking, but I want to thank all three of you for coming and giving your interesting perspectives and heartfelt stories. And I do hope that when the winter comes, we sit down as a community and start doing the collaboration that we need to do to figure this out so that it doesn't ever happen to us again. Never again, right?
Or at least we're in control of it next time.
Yeah, exactly.
We have time for our own input.
Yeah, exactly.
Put the fires out.
Yeah, right? Don't let them burn. Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much, Jerry Lynn, Al, and Guy, for your stories and your insights. I know we just barely scratched the surface of all the mitigating factors that combined to make last year's fire not only a physical disaster, but an emotional one for so many of us. I'd love to have you back on the show and continue the discussion. Thanks again.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. My next guest is Dr. Bob Zybak, who authored the book, The Great Fires, Indian Burning and Catastrophic Forest Fire Patterns of the Oregon Coast Range, 1491 to 1951. That's a huge mouthful, Bob.
Yep.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, tell me a little bit about yourself. Who are you?
I'm a guy that'll be 70 years old in a couple of weeks, which is kind of scary.
Good for you. You're well preserved.
We're on radio. Uh-huh. So I was born in the late 40s in Woodland, Washington, but when my ancestors moved there, it was still part of Oregon, and they came across an Oregon Trail in 1851 and 52. So got some pioneer roots, but my grandfather was Swiss, came over here in 1900, and that's where I got my name. So went to grade school in Woodland and Portland, Oregon, and high school in Salem and Portland, Oregon, and hunted and fished all over the Pacific Northwest, graduated from high school, started planting trees all over the Pacific Northwest.
Why? Why were you planting trees?
Two reasons. One, they paid $2.93 an hour when the minimum wage was about a buck and a quarter, and I didn't have to get a haircut.
Who was paying you?
A Pacific Reforestation.
Great.
And Tom McCready ran a business where he had crews in Oregon, Northern California, Washington, and Idaho. So I could go to where I wanted, and I was good at what I did. I was athletic.
And you were going to say you didn't have to cut your hair, huh?
I didn't have to get a haircut.
That's great. I love that.
And at that time, that was the late 60s, that was seen as like rebellious. So homely guys like me with long hair were suddenly popular. So,
absolutely.
I kept it.
Yeah, good for you. What worked then has got to work now.
It doesn't work anymore.
No, but of course not.
Old habits die hard. So.
So you were planting trees.
Yeah.
And then what?
After about 4 or 5 years, I wanted a business for myself because I could make more money that way planting trees. And so I ran a reforestation business for 20-some years. We did 85,000 acres of reforestation work, none of which I know of have ever burned. During that time, I planted over 2 million trees. I only know one other person that's done that many.
Wow.
So a lot
kind of Johnny Appleseed time.
Except as Douglas fir mostly.
Yeah, not apples, right?
And I was better paid than Johnny.
Yeah, so there we go.
Not that well, but then the spotted owl flew in the early 80s, and the industry started slowly falling apart as logging stopped, then the need for tree planting stopped. Then the federal government stopped even replanting burns, which started up pretty heavily in the early 90s, late 80s. And so I went back to school and studied forestry under the mistaken assumption that once I had a degree in forestry, I could spend all my time in the woods and be paid.
And that didn't work out.
I spent all my time on email.
Oh, no. Oh, no. I'm really sorry. Yeah. That's really a far cry from the woods.
It really is.
Yeah. Yeah.
The internet wasn't invented yet when I went back to school, so I didn't know that was going to be
right.
The curse.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you told me, if
I could just circle back here a second. Okay. So what you said was that the Forest Service stopped planting trees in burned areas.
Yeah.
Why?
Good question.
Oh, okay.
They're planting, you had what, 170,000 acres of the Chetco fire burn?
190.
190, and how much are they going to replant? Four.
Yeah.
And actually what happened in the early 80s or mid 80s, they went to diversity employment, then they started playing games, and suddenly whole large crews of illegal aliens, sometimes with illegal alien bidders, business owners started doing all of the government work. So Mexican workers, typically illegal, they were being busted all the time, started moving in large numbers up to the Northwest to do tree planting and pre-commercial thinning for the Forest Service and state forests. So that drove the prices down. And then with the great reductions in logging and the great reductions in reforestation, most of us, like the sawmill workers and the loggers, went broke and did something else. Just got forced out.
Okay, I'm a little speechless because the idea of crews of people who were in the country, undocumented,
yep,
working for
illegal
the government,
yep,
It just, I'm not, that seems outrageous.
It kind of is. There's a girl that from Northern California, I think Redding, that did her master's thesis on that, interviewed me on the topic, and she was looking specifically at the demographics of Mexican workers, and they were very few of them legal. I hired several myself. I found out years later after we're all friends and they'd worked for me for years and were making 3 and 4 times more than if they were working for another Mexican worker. They were all illegal. So it was a racket. It pretty much destroyed the reforestation industry as we knew it. And logging and sawmilling were closely related for different reasons.
So talk to me a little bit about the book that you wrote, because this is going back way far, right? I mean, 1491 is basically before Columbus set foot.
Right. And so, and the book is about Indian burning patterns and catastrophic wildfire patterns of the Oregon Coast Range. And technically, we're in the Klamath Siskiyous here. So you have to go up to the middle fork of the Coquille and then up to the Columbia River to hit the Coast Range. That area is different than here. It doesn't have lightning. Very rarely has lightning, and it's usually accompanied by rain. So almost all the fires are human-caused. And when I was a kid, there was the Tillamook burn that was well-known, the 6-year jinx, fires happening in 33, 39, 45, and 51 every 6 years. There's a Sundance burn in Idaho as I became older and a tree planter. And then there's a Yakult burn where my family was saved from getting burned up in 1902 by Spelei Prairie, an Indian prairie. Spelei means coyote. So there's a lot of fascination there with these huge events. The government in 1912 put out a report on the worst forest fires in U.S. history. I think they listed 12 of them, and 3 of them were in the Oregon Coast Range, the Tillamook, the Yaquina, and the Coos.
They were purposely set?
Well, we don't know what the motives were of the people.
Okay.
They were human caused.
They weren't lightning?
No. Yeah. No.
Okay.
There was, in fact, the first lightning fire in the Coast Range that was recorded was 1928. It was just a few thousand acres. And the guy that recorded it was the supervisor of the Siuslaw Law, and he was shocked. He didn't believe that lightning could cause a forest fire.
Wow.
Never seen or heard of one.
Wow.
Yep. Well, we know different now.
So what's the thinking about those fires, those huge fires that...
In what respect?
Well, why were you looking into them?
It was interesting to me. I lived in the Yaquina Burn in Eddyville, and I was doing tree planting, so I was coming across these fires a lot, and I was discussing them with a professor. And when I went back to school in the late 80s, because I went broke as a tree planter and my family fell apart and I lost my land, and I was desperate enough to become a student.
That's desperate.
It's pretty desperate.
Yeah, it is.
I was almost 40 and I was a single parent at times. He said, you know, he studied fire. He was a German. Actually, he was a soldier during World War II for Germany. He said, you know, nobody's ever done a history of a Coast Range fire. So I did one for his class when I was going back to school. I was probably a sophomore or something then, but I was like 38 or 39 years old. And it was about 120 pages. They're used to like 10-page student reports, but I was into the topic. And he said, this is really good, and you should follow up on this. And then 10 or 12 years later, when I was going for my PhD, I thought, well, bingo, I'll just follow up on that. I've already done most of the research. And the reason I ended in 1951 was the 6-year jinx of Tillamook fires. And from 1951 until the Silver Complex fire in 87, I think, there was only one large fire, 10,000 acres and larger, in Western Oregon during all of those years.
Wow.
Yeah, in the 1966 I'm going to forget the name of it, but is on the other Smith River, going into the mouth of the Umpqua. Dang, can't think of the name of it, but Oxbow, the 1966 Oxbow burn. That was the only fire from 53 to 87. 52, we had some bad fires. 51, the last Tillamook burn. And then last year, we had 10 such fires, Checo Bar being one, all 10 of them on federal land, which is statistically significant. That's what they taught us to say. So you have 10 out of 10 fires all on federal land in 1 year compared to one fire in 35 years, also on federal land. And so what happened? And so in the early 90s, May and a small handful of other people were saying, if you create these wilderness areas, if you stop logging, you're going to have massive fires like 1910, 1902, 1933, because the fuel will build up. If you're going to make these wilderness areas, you need to actively manage them. And so we were ignored, and we've had the fires. So these predictions come true. They were made on the basis of scientific predictions, and they've been ignored because they contradict the modelers.
And management of forests, when we were talking with Merv George and Jerry Lynn Thompson, management is about getting rid of the understory as well as doing selective logging so that you don't have all of that fuel that he called them ladder fuels.
Yeah, ladder fuels, ground fuels. Mm-hmm. There's two types of two basic types of forest fire. One's a ground fire. And so you got the pine region, which has open canopies and long needles, and they grow wide, far apart. And so those tend to keep down ladder fuels, of course, but ladder fuels aren't much of a problem there. Then you have Douglas fir, which crown out. When the fire gets up to the crown, it'll do just like it did here, kill all the trees. So it's a stand replacement event. So it doesn't rejuvenate the forest, it kills it.
Oh.
So you don't want the ground fuels or the ladder buildup on Douglas fir forests because of fire, and you don't want it in pine forests because of competition.
That's amazing. And I think, you know, most of us don't really know. You know, we look out and we see this enormous swath of green, and it's forest, and we don't know really what's in the forest.
Nope, and they don't teach it in school.
No.
Or what was in the forest, or why that might be important for managing the forest.
I think the idea of, well, you know, we're just going to let the wilderness alone and let it be free and be whatever it is might not be the best plan.
It's really stupid. The people that are saying just let it be don't know what they're talking about. So, and why do they have all that authority? We're giving a whole lot of authority to a small fraction of people that know why they're even creating wilderness in the first place. It sounds good. It sells well. Lots of lawyers have made a lot of money with it. But you go into a wilderness and you find huckleberry fields and stone carvings and artifacts. And it's like, well, people have been here for thousands of years. And now you look at the demographics we were talking earlier. And you're talking about healthy white males, basically, and some women, but kids, old people, people in poor physical health, all minorities, they don't go into wilderness areas. They've got no reason to be there. And the few people that do use the wilderness area, it's the most odd form of elitism that we've got going. There's no taxes paid on the property. They don't have to pay an entry fee.
Isn't that interesting?
We're creating a desired environment by people that don't like people.
Right, right.
That like solitude in the forest, so they think they can just set aside millions of acres for their personal enjoyment.
But it's not even smart management.
It's
because
stupid.
If you look at what happens, if yep. you don't take care of that understory and clean out that brush, what you've got—
Or the trees.
Is what we've got right now. We've got these huge mega fires that
yep.
are just burning everything in sight.
As predicted 25 years ago.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. Usually in my life, I was a little bit into athletics when I was younger, and then you work in the woods and people are kind of coarse. And So every time I've been called a girl's name up until last week, it's usually been derogatory. At the best, teased. But last week I got called a Cassandra in print, in national print. And I thought, well, that's true.
So isn't Cassandra the one who foretold events?
And nobody would believe her. And I think she went nuts when Troy burnt. So
yeah.
I didn't go nuts when the Checo fire burned.
Well, you haven't gone nuts yet, right?
Or maybe I'm nuts for talking to you right now. I'm just like.
So can you talk a little bit about the Checo fire last year?
Yeah, it started in the Calmeopsis Wilderness. Mm-hmm. The Calmeopsis was one of the very first wildernesses. It was set aside specifically to protect rare and endangered plants, a number of them.
And I've heard that those plants weren't to be found anywhere else.
Yeah, they're endemic, and they're based on a real unusual soil on a real old geography. So they're isolated, endemic, unusual mm-hmm. plants.
Mm-hmm.
And so I predicted accurately, you know, if you just let it go, it's going to turn into a bonfire.
Right.
And it's beyond thinning. You got to do logging. You got to do clear cutting in Douglas fir regions for some of the main reasons we just mentioned. So in 87, it burnt. Then in 2002, 15-year jinx, it burnt again. Then in 2017, it burnt again. And this year, 2018, it burnt again. It didn't mm-hmm. wait 15 years this time.
No.
But if you look at the pattern, Onion Peak, which burned in 2014, and the Checo burn, which was last year, are two of the main areas that aren't burning and that they're trying to use as a buffer now.
Mm-hmm.
So those predictable fires, the question is, and I am curious why the environmentalists aren't asking this, what effect did it have on those rare and endangered plants that it was set up to preserve?
Have to assume that they are dead.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily. They might not have been flammable. They might have been growing in rock outcrops or something like that.
Okay.
But one area that we've had up on YouTube for about 10 years, near Babyfoot Lake, they set that aside as a preserve for Brewer's spruce, which is pretty rare. And it was around the banks of the lake, which is a glacial formation, which is pretty rare in western Oregon. At these elevations. So the first fire, Silver Complex, burned up close to there. And people like me were saying, it's going to get worse. You got to get that fuel out of there. It's not green trees now. It's firewood.
Right.
And it's real pitchy and it's dry and there's tons of it per acre. And you know what happens when you light firewood and you have lightning through here. And so that's the Cassandra part. Everybody said, we're from the Forest Service. Here's some acronyms and metrics or something.
Right.
It was gibberish. But it was the rationale for keeping it. And what effect did that fire have on the Calmeopsis? And what can you do to mitigate that so it doesn't happen again? Or what can you do to help those plants that maybe were disturbed by the fire?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's asking that question.
Mm-mm.
Why not?
Mm-mm.
And so I've been asking again for the last year. It's like, well, how did these fires impact those rare plants that we set aside, I don't know, 100,000 or 200,000 acres to preserve in the late 60s? Could we have been wrong? Could this be an unanticipated consequence?
Mm-hmm.
And
but we could have, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but couldn't we have set aside that land to protect those things and yet done management in the lands around them so that we didn't end up with these mega fires?
It's probably necessary. Not only was it an option that nobody thought of or did or took part in, but it's probably necessary. Probably a lot of those plants were dependent on regular disturbance by people before it was a wilderness.
Because there was regular disturbance by people before it was a wilderness.
Yes.
I mean, I think that's the thing that we keep forgetting is that because the native tribes were here.
And white people, too, and livestock.
But those lands have all been touched.
Oh,
they've
yeah.
all been managed.
Yep.
It's not like.
Well, there's some that maybe not. There's some isolated areas in the Rockies and Alaska that maybe.
Right. Right.
Certainly in Western Oregon, these lands were heavily occupied for thousands and thousands of years.
Right.
The tribes will say time immemorial. Archaeologists will say 10,000 plus years. You look at the Willamette Valley, the Umpqua Valley, the Rogue Valley, and not understand that those are millions of acres that were meticulously managed with fire and digging sticks and knives for thousands of years. And so now we're just letting them degrade and grow to ruin and all feel good about it because we preserved it, except when we're breathing smoke and looking at the fire and that.
I just don't think that we've understood. I think that, you know.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's what Cassandra means.
Yes, that's true.
Nobody will believe you. It's like, oh, okay.
No, that's true. But I've heard it said many times, follow the money. You know, if you don't understand why something happened or if you don't understand what happened, follow the money.
Yeah.
So what does that look like in this case?
Well, for the environmental lawyers, their industry didn't even exist before NEPA and wilderness, so it's been a real boon. For the bureaucrats...
NEPA, tell me what NEPA is.
National Environmental...
Protection,
maybe. Okay. Boy, there's the misnomer. Okay. Act.
Okay.
And now there's thousands and thousands of people that work for the federal government on NEPA. So all the bureaucrats have, and then the college professors that are doing modeling based on NEPA requirements, which are regulations that are supposedly based on biology at some level.
But you don't think so?
Pretty crappy biology.
Yeah.
Not very good.
Yeah.
I think we talked earlier that the so-called experts on wildlife habitat have drawn perfect circles for spotted owl habitat, put them across the landscape, and driven the humans out of those circles. Kind of like the wilderness where humans are pathogens and we're up to no good, so keep out and because we know better. And so it's the same.
And again, I just think that there has to be a way. I mean, I don't want to lose species. I don't want to lose species. But there has to
be. What happened to those mastodons?
Yeah, I really feel bad about them. I'd like to.
They were probably killed off by people.
Well, or they were killed off by something hitting the earth or, you know.
Something.
Whatever.
But it
would seem to me that, you know, there'd be a way of keeping it all, you know, preserving the species that are
We're always going to lose some species. Mm-hmm. And then what they're doing now is the lawyers and the bureaucrats took over. So they've got incredible species. The most common brown-eyed owl in North America, you've probably heard of it, a hoot owl?
Yeah.
Okay. Hoot owls are the most common brown-eyed owl in North America.
Okay.
A couple other names for them are barred owls and spotted owls.
Okay.
So spotted owls are really a rare species, but they are producing viable young with the barred owls. When I was in grade school, that meant they were the same species. So I've given two presentations at Oregon State a couple years ago, a couple weeks apart, and I talked to all the grad students in forestry, and then I talked to all the grad students in fish and wildlife. And I first put up Darwin's definition of a species, and he didn't even call them a subspecies or a variation. Let's see, called them, I can't think of the name right now. It doesn't matter. But he said, you know, if you isolate a species in a certain area, it'll grow up with characteristics to match the area. For instance, mastodons, the last ones we know of, an island outside of Alaska, were tiny because they had small area.
So I
used the example of a pygmy and a Swede. And I said, okay, colorization different, physiology different, vocalization different, preferred habitat different, preferred food different, totally different. There's not a single case in the world that I've ever heard of a pygmy and a Swede having a viable child. So, are they the same species? Well, we were taught they were. They're the human species. Well, then I compared a barred owl and a spotted owl. Same preferred habitat, same preferred food, Hmm. One's got dots and one's got dashes. Mm-hmm. One's a hoot owl with a slightly different call than the other hoot owl. Mm-hmm. They just grew up in different environments, developed different characteristics. The barred owl is more aggressive. We were taught in college at that time that it filled a niche or a niche, depending who was saying it, and that it was important to have each component part of this ecosystem, interdependent, and that that would prove that the barred owl was a better fit than the spotted owl. So those people, the should have been cheering barred owl incursions into spotted owl territory, again, a new and better part for the ecology machine.
Interesting.
But instead, they spent $120 million to systematically kill barred owls in the guise of saving spotted owls. And they're still killing barred owls. Now, the reason I use humans, I was called a racist for doing it. That was the word I was trying to think of, race. Two different races of people, two different races of owl. And
Interesting.
Here we are causing tens of billions of dollars worth of damage to tens of thousands of families and hundreds of rural communities based on some kind of genetic variation between these two owls.
Okay.
That's why I say it's stupid. It's not ignorant, because those people aren't ignorant, but it's really self-destructive, and it's really bad. It's management, but my goodness, we've got better things. We got kids in trouble in Detroit, and we're killing barred owls by the million-dollar amounts. It's
so, Dr. Bob, yeah. I hate to tell you this, but we're almost out of time.
Wow, that was quick.
I know, right? Isn't it amazing how time flies?
Yep.
Do you have any, last thoughts you'd like to leave with us?
Well, I think that active management is what has been taken away from the Forest Service. When it was actively managed, roads were maintained, trees were logged, trees were planted. We had a lot more wildlife because they weren't dying in wildfires. We had a lot healthier local communities because they weren't breathing smoke all summer. We had a lot less frightened humans because they weren't being threatened with wildfire. We had tens of thousands more jobs, good-paying jobs, for people that didn't have a college education and qualified to be a bureaucrat or a lawyer or a college professor. So there's been a real demographic shift based on income levels and location. And it's been a racket, I think, for the legal, scientific, with quotes around it, professions. And it's been a real detriment to our rural families and communities. And we need to start actively managing our public lands again for the benefit of people, wildlife, and Cassandra.
Thank you very much for coming on the show. It's been a real pleasure having you here.
I've enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Our Community with my guests Jerry Lynn Thompson, Al Stroh, Guy McMahon, and Dr. Bob Zybak. The podcast for this show can be found on our website, kciw.org. While you're there, check out some of our other shows. And if you like what you hear and want to hear more, consider becoming a member of KCIW for $25 a year and getting involved. We're always looking for our talented volunteers to do both in front of and behind the microphone. We're community radio of, by, and for the people. Thanks for being part of our community. This is Candace Michelle.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.